This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Assets north of $25 billion, several thousand employees, 15 different business units. Put it all together and you get one of the largest and most influential organizations in America. So what does it take to lead such a business?
Especially if that business is in education, and especially if that business's name is Harvard. For that matter, what does it take to be a successful leader in any industry of any size?
Well, Harvard's president, Drew Gilpin-Faust, joins us today to offer her answers to those questions. Welcome to Radio Boston, President Faust.
Thank you.
Well, President Faust is with us because she is one of 70 CEOs who sat down with Adam Bryant, deputy national editor of the New York Times. The CEOs shared their insights on what it takes to make a great leader. And Bryant's compiled those interviews into a new book entitled The Corner Office: Indispensable and Unexpected Lessons from CEOs on How to Lead and Succeed. Adam Bryant, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me on the show, Meghna.
Well, listeners, the keys to great leadership, common sense advice in an uncommon combination. That is our talker today. So what do you think the traits are that make for great leaders? And are they the same traits celebrated on the covers of business magazines? Are they something different? And, you know, there's an entire industry built around leadership studies with so many formulas for inspiring leadership out there. Why does it still seem like it's in such short supply? Give us a call with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Drew Gilpin-Faust, I'm going to get to you in just a minute to talk about the specifics of leading a major institution like Harvard. But Adam Bryant, I wonder if you could kick us off here. I mean, in the corner office, you've compiled these 70 interviews kind of down to five of the essential nuggets of wisdom that these CEOs shared with you. So if you were to put up a PowerPoint slide with those five bullet points, what would they be?
Sure. And very briefly, and I'll give you 10 seconds of context here, that CEOs are almost always interviewed as strategists. And what I really tried to do was ask them how they lead, and just as importantly, how they learn to lead. And from that, I literally had about a million words of transcripts, and I just started studying them and asking what are the broader themes that evolve from all these interviews, not only in their personal stories, but also what they look for when they hire. And from that emerge five qualities. I'll run through them very quickly. The first one is passionate curiosity, which is a really deep sense of engagement with the world. The leaders I interviewed are curious about people. They're curious about how organizations work and how they can be made to work better. The second one is battle-hardened confidence, which is really a track record of facing down adversity in their personal lives, their professional lives, really gives them a sense of confidence that whatever the task that is thrown at them, they're going to take on and succeed with. The third one is team smarts, which I like to think of, it's the organizational equivalent of street smarts. And we all know what street smarts is. You sort of have a sense of the unwritten rules of the neighborhood. You know how to get things done. You know who is really in charge. And I think that plays out in two ways. One, in an organization, you know how to bring people together for kind of an ad hoc project, even if they don't report to you. And then secondly, you have an antenna in a meeting setting or in a group setting. You understand the body language, how people are sort of interacting. Mm-hmm. The fourth one is a simple mindset. Because of the internet, we all have an ocean of data available at our fingertips. And a simple mindset is the ability to look at it all and really just pull out the one, two, or three things that really matter. And it's really important for leaders to be able to say to a group of, 10,000 employees, these are the three things we're focusing on this year. These are the two things. It's not helpful to say to them, keep in mind these 17 points. And finally, fearlessness, which really refers to, something that plays out in, again, in both their personal and professional lives. It's the ability to say in the context of their job, maybe things are going fine, maybe things look really just okay, but I'm going to break it. I'm going to turn it upside down, inside out, because I think it can be made better. Mm-hmm. It's also manifested in people's careers that they might take surprising career moves to get the experience, even demote themselves, take a lateral move because they're not taking that traditional ladder. So those are the five.
Well, listeners, what do you make of it? Passionate curiosity, battle-hardened confidence, team smarts, a simple mindset, and fearlessness. Do those sound like the characteristics of a great leader to you? And if you've worked for someone who's made a difference in your organization, what made them different? And I guess I'm also wondering, what does it take to nurture greater and better leadership in the United States today. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Drew Gilpin-Faust, you know, as we started this segment, you run one of the most influential and in a sense, largest organizations in America, clearly a very important one in higher education. Did these five characteristics, do you think that they characterize what you believe is required to be a successful university president?
Well, universities are interesting organizations, a bit different perhaps from many of the organizations that the leaders Adam interviewed run. But they have certain aspects in common as well. So as I came to his book after having spoken with him about 2 years ago, I looked at some of his conclusions and thought, how do they play out within a university setting? What are the peculiarities or the special characteristics? And of course, the first characteristic, passionate curiosity, is at the center of what universities are about, because we want our faculty and our students to have passionate curiosity about knowledge and about the different ways in which it might advance and about enhancing their knowledge and their opportunities for discovery. So to have a leader who's passionately curious is almost essential, because you're the leader of the curious. Mm-hmm. And to understand what your constituents are about, you have to understand what that curiosity is and to share it. So very much a part of a university leadership set of attributes.
But I wonder if there's a particular challenge within that, because being a leader of the curious, it seems like it's often, you know, to use an old adage, like herding cats, because they're curious mm-hmm. in all sorts of different directions. And especially in a place like Harvard, where there are so many, there's a variety of institutions within mm-hmm. the college, and everyone may have their own personal little fiefdom mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. To get them to move in one direction under the umbrella of the university would be a particular challenge.
Well, that's where Adam's characteristic of team smarts has to come in. It's understanding a particular culture and what that culture requires, at least as I read him, and he can weigh in and say, I haven't understood him, or I have. but it seemed to me that team smarts means understanding your environment, understanding what moves you need to make on the court that other people will respond to take his own metaphor. And so universities are very collaborative places in which a variety of individuals with different voices and perhaps different agendas all feel that they're part of the community that needs to be heard and that needs to have a role. And so that's a bit different from a more structured organization with a hierarchy. And the leadership is more distributed. It has to be more team-based, actually, mm-hmm. in a university, perhaps, than in many other organizations.
I mean, Adam Bryan, is that necessarily, do you think that's true? Because, I mean, I note that in your list of the 70 leaders that you interviewed, you definitely have several people from the private sector, obviously, many. Carol Bartz from CEO, Ursula Burns, Carol Bartz from Yahoo, I should say, Ursula Burns from Xerox. You interviewed Drew Gilpin-Faust as well. Wendy Kopp, founder and CEO of Teach for America, so many people from the nonprofit sector as well. Do you find that the characteristics for great leadership, that there were sort of similarities across the board, or that as President Faust here is saying, that there were particularities that maybe didn't apply to certain industries or sectors?
I think there was far more in common than different. I think at the core of so much of leadership is creating a sense of mission to get people aligned and galvanized around a common goal. And I think people do that in business. They do it in nonprofits. And they do it in a university setting. And it's really the ability, the art, to create that sense of mission that everybody can believe in, to have that sense of shared commitment. And it is, a university is an interesting setting, and President Faust has spoken to this, and people do have their own personal interests. They're part of smaller subsets within somewhat larger subsets, and then there's the broader one of the overall university. And in my interview with President Faust, she referred to, there was a meeting, I don't know if you'd like to pick it up, President Faust, the meeting of all the deans, and you had a smart way to get them thinking about the broader whole.
This, I think you're referring to a meeting early on in my presidency where I was trying to create a sense of unity among all the deans and unity among all the schools in pursuit of university-wide goals and a university-wide mission. And Michael Porter, the strategist, came to that meeting, and he suggested that each dean ask, how does being part of Harvard University give my school, give me an unfair advantage? In other words, to try to make each school and its leader understand that they could be even better by being part of the larger whole. And so creating incentives for collaboration in a situation where the individual purposes might otherwise have weighed very heavily on each school.
Was it an effective inquiry? I mean, did the deans get on board, or did they come up with good responses?
The deans were very impressed by that question and began answering it in terms of their own schools. And it's a question that I have posed to them again and again over the ensuing 4 years to underline how it's in all of our interests to work together in ways that enable us to take advantage of synergies and to be bigger than any single part of us could be.
Mm. Adam Bryant, you know, there comes this perennial question when it comes to leadership, and you've sort of categorized the basic traits into five new categories, you know, the passionate curiosity, battle-hardened confidence, team smarts, a simple mindset, fearlessness. And I repeat them because they're very, once you hear them, it makes a lot of sense. Like, okay, these are traits in which that good leaders demonstrate. But then it comes down to that age-old question of, can you learn it?
I think you can. I liken these qualities, if you will, a little bit to sort of diet and exercise, that every day we make decisions on diet and exercise, and that has results. And I think these five qualities, they are things that you can work on. They are matters of attitude and habit and discipline. And they are also things that you generally encounter in ways large and small every single day of your life. When you're in a team setting, I mean, I've talked to people who have said that doesn't come naturally to them, but they actually make an effort. They'll learn personal details about some of their colleagues, and then they'll write it down on a note card because they understand that it's not a natural strength, but they're trying to work on it, mm-hmm. again, just like diet and exercise.
Drew Gilpin-Faust, I mean, I don't imagine that when you were 20 or 25 that you went out and ran to the bookstore and read all the literature there is about leadership, and yet you find yourself in this position. So as president of Harvard University, so how is it that you think you prepared for being a leader?
I didn't read books about leadership. That's very true. I guess I prepared for being a leader by taking on leadership positions as a fairly young person in student government or being president of my class or running some effort or initiative or organization. I think, though, Adam, I would say that there's certain tendencies or temperament characteristics that maybe bring people into wanting to be leaders. And you certainly can learn about being a leader, and you certainly can discipline yourself to do it better and to recognize aspects that you'd like to strengthen. But what makes someone want to do it in the first place and want to take that discipline? And that seems to me the sense that an organization, something bigger than yourself, can give you enormous satisfaction, and that you care about something beyond your own individual self, and that you want to suppress, sublimate your own individual goals to advance larger goals.
Is that what made you want to do it?
Yes, I think it was. I thought, I can make a contribution here, and I can serve this larger community or serve these larger purposes, and amplify what I might be able to do as an individual on behalf of others. So, Adam, did you think at all about what brings people to leadership and why some people would choose to undertake the discipline you describe or the education you describe?
It's a very good question. These five qualities, they're really, to me, the things that separate people as they move up in an organization, and trying to answer the question, why do people get those promotions all mm-hmm. the way up to the mm-hmm. top? What are the qualities? So, but then there is this question that I wrestle with in the last chapter of the book. So what is leadership?
Exactly.
Because
mm-hmm.
there is that X factor. There is something inside these people. And I tried to put my finger on a couple of things. Again, these things emerge from the interviews. It's not like I came at it with some silver bullet theory. But there is this sort of underlying passion for what's possible. Leaders, I think, see opportunities. They see virgin snow that others don't. I think that's one. I think there's this quality of wanting to share the weight together, that in this service of the broader goal, that they know how to bring people together and want to achieve that. And another thing that I think is really important is that they know how to tell a story around a person, that they see a narrative for somebody that person might not see for themselves. That's why I heard a lot of CEOs said, you know, I took my head of marketing and I put them in finance because I thought that would be good for them. And I asked them to trust me. And I think those are things that you're at a very high level there. I'm not going to say, oh, yeah, this is the textbook. Just work on this. You'll be all set.
Well, we are talking about leadership and some common sense advice, maybe in an uncommon combination that you've never heard before. My guests are Adam Bryant. He's deputy national editor of The New York Times and author of The Corner Office, Indispensable and Unexpected Lessons from CEOs on How to Lead and Succeed. I'm also joined by Drew Gilpin-Faust. She is the president of Harvard University. So listeners, what do you make of what you've heard? Do these sound like the keys, the recipe to great leadership? If you've worked with someone who was a great leader for you, what made them different? And I'm going to ask again, why don't we see more of that in the American workplace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a quick call from Newton. Tom is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Tom.
Well, thank you. I think this is an important discussion, and I think that all the ideas do reflect American leadership. However, I had a rare opportunity in the late 80s and early 90s to be a personal consultant to Sam Walton, who told me something very simple about leadership, which is it's a solid dream. And when he said a solid dream, he meant that he had a dream for his company and the people in his company, and not only did he share that dream, but he helped them realize that dream.
Hey, Tom, did Sam Walton, of course, founder of Walmart, did he tell you how he got all people on board with that dream?
He, you know, the Sam's secret was that he treated everybody as an individual, and so he could say to them, my dream is only as big as your dream. And by doing that, he entice people to share his dream and to work with him on building it. So he had everybody contributing to building the great pyramid that Walmart's become, which is probably the best business story in the history of the world, because it started as a Ben Franklin store in Arkansas.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Drew Gilpin-Faust, I mean, you must have faced similar challenges with, and I know you did when you were the head of the Radcliffe Institute, like trying to basically move a ship in a new direction, or as Tom calls it, getting people to believe in a new dream. And, you know, how did you bring people on board with your vision?
It seems to me a central aspect of that is situating that vision in a context that matters to people, and to understand what the individuals you wish to move or lead identify as the values and the commitments that will be most important to them. And then what you want has to seem to grow naturally out of that. So a lot of it is communication, making people understand why their lives will be different and better if they move in terms of your dreams for them, so that those dreams become their dreams. There has to be that match. And in a way, it goes back to what Adam was saying a few minutes ago, which is recognizing things in people that you can cultivate, whether it's to have them be leaders alongside you or to have them follow along beside you. You need to understand where they are and what they need in order to be motivated to move with you. So communication and understanding is critical.
Even when the direction that you want to move in involves layoffs and cost cutting. I mean, I went back and read some of the coverage when you were appointed head of Harvard University, and there was, you know, when you wanted to evolve the Radcliffe Institute, it did come at a cost to some people. And I read that Elizabeth Warren sort of jokingly said that they referred to you as Chainsaw Drew because of the way that you really did sort of cut the fat out of the institution.
But people were very calm about it, and they understood it because we communicated throughout our process of evaluating our budgets at Radcliffe back in 2003 about the necessity we saw to make some changes. And by the time we announced what the changes would be, people were very understanding that this needed to happen if the institution was going to survive and thrive. And they knew that a job in an institution that wasn't surviving and thriving would ultimately not be a good thing, so that they were at a moment where they could have a choice that led forward for the institution. And so we had very good reception of those changes.
Let's take another call here. Linnea is calling from Brookline. You're on the air, Linnea.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to add a very simple aspect to leadership, and that is that leaders actually listen to their people. And I find this day and age, with the complexity of technology and so much going on, that a lot of times employers or leaders, I don't feel at times, are very present to their workers.
Mm. Linnea, thank you so much for your call. Adam Bryant, your response to that.
It's an excellent point. This is something that came up in so many of my interviews, and a lot of them do things like they'll hold meetings and have a little basket by the door and say, everybody put your BlackBerry in there, put your iPhone in there, because the CEO wanted everybody, again, that word, to be present during the meeting. And I can't underscore enough the importance of listening. I think it's such a magical word in leadership. When people feel like they are being listened to, it just means so much. And CEOs also understand that good ideas can come from anywhere and anybody in their organization, and they listen very intently for those.
Go ahead.
I would just add that listening is the most essential part of what I do, because listening is learning. And if you want to lead people, you need to understand where they are. If they're in a place that's different from where you want them to be, you need to understand why. And only by listening can you get enough information to understand what your next steps need to be.
Well, Drew Faust, let me ask you about that, because, I mean, you've had challenges to your leadership at Harvard University. And, for example, when you look across the river to Harvard's development of the Alston property and how that's essentially been stalled, I'm sure a lot of the constituents there, in other words, the residents who live there, feel that perhaps you haven't listened enough, or that no amount of listening is really going to help the situation. So how do you respond to what may be a question of the limits of or the I don't want to say failings, but the challenge that's posed to your leadership of the situation?
Well, when you listen to people, it doesn't mean that you're going to do every single thing that they tell you. It means that you'll understand why they're saying what they are and what it the best you can do for them. So we've worked very hard to listen to the Alston community and to recognize their concerns about our need to slow development there, to respond to their requests that we do more leasing of vacant properties, that we improve the area with greening and a new park that we're about to open, that we provide educational opportunities in Alston, which we've done through the Alston portal that involves classes for many, many children in the area, that we bring some of the educational resources of Harvard to the community. So there's certain things we can listen to and understand and respond to. And then, because of the financial downturn, there were some other things that they would have wished we'd done, which was continue with the building, that we were unable at that time to do.
Mm. Well, I want to squeeze in one more call in here. Dennis is calling from Belmont. You're on the air, Dennis.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I just wanted to say that my point was made a minute ago. For leadership, there's a bit of a fine balance between the ego and humility, and great leaders, I think, understand. My former boss in Uganda.
Dennis, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it sounds like we're losing your cell phone. But you said that great leaders have a mixture of humility and ego. And Adam Bryant, that actually leads me to someone who blurbed your book, Jim Collins. I mean, he's written exactly about that, about what he calls level five leadership, that the greatest leaders have this sort of unrelenting vision, but that one that is not, that's backed by incredible humility. They're not the people you hear about or see on the covers of business magazines. So, how does this play into your new framework of leadership? And by virtue of highlighting these 70 people, are we going down the wrong direction anyway? Maybe we should be talking about the people we've never even heard of.
No, I think, first of all, you can learn leadership from any leader. And what I've really come to understand through doing Corner Office for 2 years is that people react very differently to these interviews. There's no suit you take off the rack and say, this is how to lead. It has to come from within you. And I hope these 70 leaders in the book, including President Faust, will serve as mentors to people as they learn to lead. But to this question, humility, ego, what I've really come to understand is that so much of leadership is about apparent contradictions and finding a balance between them. Something as simple as you want to be friendly as a boss, but not someone's friend. You want to be a boss, but not bossy. So many of the discussions, I thought, well, how can you be this but not that? And the answer is you have to be both. But it's finding that balance in so many areas where you feel like this is a contradiction, but it has to be both.
So it can be learned, but it still feels like there's a touch of magic in there when it comes to how to find that balance. Adam Bryant, Deputy National Editor of the New York Times and author of The Corner Office, Indispensable and Unexpected Lessons from CEOs on How to Lead and Succeed. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Drew Gilpin-Faust, President of Harvard University. True pleasure to speak with you. Hope you'll join us again sometime on Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio Boston.